Stop Starvation Marketing, 23 Power Growth Moves for Health Tech, IT, and Biotech Companies. That's a new book by Christine Slocum, founder of Clarity Quest, an innovative marketing and PR agency that is part of the Supreme Group. Hi, I'm Carol Flagg, and on this episode, Chris, who is now the Chief Growth Officer for Supreme, and I discuss some of my favorite chapters and anecdotes from the book. Take a listen. Hello, hello, hello. Chris Slocum, how are you? Welcome to our recording of What's My Tagline. It's so good to see you. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Carol. It's nice to see you.
We are, of course, going to be talking today about your book, Stop Starvation Marketing, which I'm very excited about. Last time we talked, it had not been released yet. And now, of course, it's available on Amazon and all of that. As you know, Chris, before we get into the heart of our conversation, my first question of all my guests is always, if you had to describe yourself as a tagline, what would it be?
I love it. I love it. It's always your question, Carol. It's always your good I'd say leading with persistent purpose. I'm stubborn, but I think in a good way. Right? I'm like, if people tell me I can't do something, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to try and figure out how to make that happen. But then pulling in the leadership angle as well. And actually, I just want to mention to the audience here today, I do have a new title as of a couple of weeks ago. I'm not the president of Clarity Quest anymore. I am the Chief Growth Officer of Supreme Group, which is a leading agency for life sciences and for health tech, of which Clarity Quest is a part. And there are two other organizations, Supreme Optimization, and one as of this week, Health and Commerce, joined us.
So, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, so leading all sales with a persistent purpose. It has to be that way, Carol.
And anybody that knows you knows you're pretty persuasive and persistent. So before we talk about the book, I know your background and kind of the unusual path you took into marketing and sales. It's not certainly traditional. And you actually talk about it in your book, in your preface, which is your mess to success story. So if you could just spend a couple minutes so the audience gets to know you a little bit. And again, talk about your journey. It's not often you run into a marketing expert who also holds patents.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a weird egg. That's why it's a mess to success. It had a lot of learnings along the way. I started as an electrical engineer, and I worked for a very large company that at the time was extremely successful. In the pocket of every NBA star, as I say in the book, everyone knew it, huge Fortune 50, and then it collapsed. And it collapsed because of bad marketing in my estimation, along with some other things. But that company was Motorola. And I learned a lot of lessons there, being an engineer and then working in product marketing there and seeing a company that had everything in its grasp, but forgot about marketing and brand and voice of customer and focused everything on the technology, which to this day, like Motorola is a great phone, like from the guts of the phone, like what's in there, connecting calls, all that kind of stuff. But they forgot about user interface. They forgot about listening to customers. They forgot about cool colors. They forgot about actually marketing. Marketing is where you went when you didn't have a career actually at Motorola. As I mentioned in the book, my boss was like, why do you want to go into marketing? Like, oh, that's like where you go if you can't hack it as an engineer.
that's dark side. What are you doing?
Oh, yeah, you're going really over into the dark side. You're going to ruin your career. So I was like, and then I saw Nokia eat our lunch. And then I saw, of course, Apple come in, and the rest is history. But that was a really good lesson, early days to be a young engineer and product marketer, and then going, oh my gosh, look what happened to this company that put no focus on marketing. And at the time I was going for my MBA because I really liked the left brain, right brain side of being in a tech company, but doing creative marketing. And so I'm like taking all these classes and I'm like, we're not doing any of this. Like, what's going on here? Right. And then it came to fruition. So today, a lot of companies have learned that lesson, but a lot of companies have not learned that lesson. And that's why I wrote the book, Stop Starvation Marketing, because I still see this trend of tech companies, whether it's in health tech, biotech, general IT tech, ignoring marketing or putting it on the back burner.
So that cautionary tale, actually, that was actually in chapter two, I believe. It's actually one of my favorite chapters of the book, because it's talking about what you're talking about, which is you fall in love with the tech is great, and that's kind of where it starts and ends. And this, and the way the book unfolds too, because you know, you talk about your journey. There's a preface by John Lynn who talks about, you know, a lot about his relationship with you. And then you move into this start again, that story of Motorola, which was obviously a change in career for you, but I read too, a huge mindset change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think I would have been an agency owner without going through that. You know, I might have switched over to marketing and stayed in-house, but I saw that and I said, oh my goodness, look what happened to this company that was large, that had everything in its favor. Then I went to work for a few startups before I started an agency. I said, oh, maybe it's different over in the startup world, right? You know, crazier, but different, right? Maybe they'll focus more on marketing. No.
No. Well, and there would be no book if that were the case.
Right, right. And yeah. So then I put two and two together and said, hey, maybe there's something here. You know, all these companies are saying like, we can't find agencies that speak fluent tech, or we don't have the focus on marketing, or we don't have the time to focus on marketing, but we have the investment so we can invest in an agency to do it for us, but we can't do it in-house because we're so focused on R&D and getting platform out, et cetera. So I kind of put two and two together and took a chance and told my husband, I'm giving it 2 years. I'll see if I can make it. If not, I can find a job again in Seattle. It's really easy to get a tech job, right? And here we are like 25 years later. So,
and you know, that's the engineer in you, right? That sort of mindset, you know, but at the same time, it's still a risk. It was risky taking a chance and writing a book. You know, I mean, that's a real risk. You know, what if I write the book? I put all this effort in the book. I have an agency book. I publish the book and nobody buys the book.
You got to put it out there because you never know. And then, I have a good friend and she's a very accomplished author. Not in this area, it's in romance, but she was like, do not look at your reviews. Like, don't read the bad ones. Because she's like, that's not your audience. You know, she was very positive about it. She's like, you're going to put it out there. You know, you have to have a thicker skin, on this. So yeah, you have your audience and you find your audience through this, which is interesting. I mean, everyone finds their community by putting themselves out there. Right. And you find those people who are supportive, who ask good questions, who, you know, ask me like, why didn't you include that? And I love that, of, you know, like some suggestions for improvement, on there, but then there's just mean, you know, and she goes, don't look at the mean, the mean.
Don't ever. Yeah, seriously. I mean, people thought Van Gogh was a bad artist, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah. We have to take risks, you know, and that's a lot of younger people come to me now and that want to start a company. And I'm really, really enthused. I was at Vive and there are a bunch of really smart younger folks and a lot of women and minorities starting companies. And I was just really enthused by that. But they were like, you know, what is this like? And I'm like, oh, the first 2 years are really hard, you know, and you have to get through it, get the funding or get the cash flow in there. But you have to put yourself out there and you have to take a risk, have enough cushion for a couple of years because the money doesn't start flowing in right away. It's funny. I have stapled like, you know, my first tax return, like when I started the business, I was like, oh my God, how did we live on that? Yeah, I was like, that's very motivating when you look at that. But you know, hey, you find a way, you pay the bills and you're perseverant, right? And getting that through. So, but I'm really enthused seeing the number of people who are starting companies and taking that risk and taking the leap of faith to do something that they really are passionate about and believe in.
Yeah. And the book, I mean, even though, first of all those people should buy the book because they're startups, number one. I mean, number two, but the book itself, even though it says it, you know, it references health health tech and IT and biotech. It actually, it really could be for any vertical. I mean, there's a lot in it. And one of the things that I think one of the major tenets of the book that you talk about is that Tower of Power methodology, right? That is sort of becomes the framework. I mean, when I first saw like, you know, Tower of Power, I think, oh, I think I played that slot machine in Vegas, but
Oh, if there is a Tower of Power slot machine, I must have a photo. Now I'm going to be my son that's near
me. I swear, I looked at the image in the book and I'm like, I swear I won the bonus.
The Tower of Financial Power is going to deliver a big cash payday for you. Yeah, well, I mean, we had that methodology forever here at Clarity Quest, but it didn't have a name. And when I was talking to my editor, he's like, you must have a methodology name. And I'm like, okay, great. So like we went through and I must give him full credit that my editor came up with that moniker. And then we just played around with a few things. But yeah, the Tower of Power is basically a methodology for any company. It doesn't matter whether you're B2B, B2C, health tech, outside of health tech. But it's proven methodology that we've implemented and then seen companies succeed when they do it. So rather than just a random act of marketing philosophy, which a lot of companies do, let's just try everything, throw spaghetti at the wall
and see what's
there, right? And we're going to throw every kind of pasta, not just spaghetti, and we're going to waste money. Let's do things in a methodical fashion. And that's probably the engineer in me. I was like, you know, let's do things in a methodical fashion with attribution, with ROI metrics in there, tracking things. So we start with messaging, know who you are, how to talk about yourself, how your partners and customers should talk about you, have a position in the marketplace, have a strong visual brand. A lot of companies forget about that. They're like, and you go to their website and you're like, how big is your company? You look like you're five people. And they're like, oh, no, we're 500. Oh, my goodness. There. So having strong messaging, positioning, visual brand, and then an actual marketing plan, which I'm amazed at the number of even mid-market and enterprise companies who do not have a true marketing plan.
Yeah.
They have a marketing budget. They may have some marketing KPIs, but they don't have a marketing plan. They haven't looked at competitive marketing analysis. What do your competitors do? Doing on the marketing front, you know, like where are your goals and how do they align to the business goals here? You might be running marketing campaigns that are for a growth strategy when your executive leadership team has an exit strategy, right? there's no alignment there. So that tower is the really foundation of building a strong foundation of messaging, marketing plan, visual brand, on which you put everything else. Once you have that foundation solidified, then it's actually a lot easier to do everything else. You're not reinventing the wheel every time you're doing it. Then build the website, content, lead gen, public relations awareness campaigns, demand gen on top of that.
And the great thing about, I mean, the book, you talk about these 23 tactics that are outlined in the book, but it's not like, oh, tactic here, tactic there. The actual order and flow of the book, the way I read it, is it is to take you from start to finish. You know, it's very strategic. I think if I were starting a company tomorrow, I'm not going to start with chapter 16. And we're going to talk about that one because I laughed out loud when I got to that point.
If you skip to this chapter, go back. Yes.
Chapter, go back.
Everyone wants a lead gen, right? Everyone's like, I need more leads. I need more leads. I need more leads. I'm like, okay.
The table of contents. Chapter 16. Right. Do not.
And they expect us to pull the genie out of the hat, whether we're in-house marketers or whether we're an agency. And I tell them, it's like, you know, you throw a person in to go run a 5K race, right? And they've not practiced at all. They haven't put any training in. And you throw them a pair of sneakers and say, like, go finish, you know, in under 21 minutes. That's not going to happen, right? But if you prepare and train and do all the hard things, you know, then you're going to succeed in your lead generation efforts. Lead generation is lead up just like training for a race or the Olympics or anything else, right? You have to put the hard sweat into it before. And then when you do that, then the phone starts ringing.
So that's definitely a spoiler alert here. If you buy the book, do not start with chapter 16.
Do not go right there, because I know you're going to go right to the lead gen. But yes, the power moves, the chapters are power moves in the book, and they flow in the order of the Tower of Power. So you start with messaging and power moves for messaging. Then you go to marketing plan, power moves for marketing plan, et cetera.
Moving forward, but I couldn't go over every chapter, so I'm talking about my favorite chapters. Chapter 7, which was right, like, pretend you won the Oscar, right? You're taking a page from Hollywood, or you won, you know, the award that you want to win. Write that acceptance speech, and you actually have a group of people who do that. And what you write about is how interesting it is that different, how varying, you know, each speech is, you know, because what that company meant to that particular person and what that messaging means. How did you come up with that? It's just a brilliant idea.
It's actually a take off something from a book called Zag. In that, you're writing like your obituary. And we didn't like that. And it was so negative, like your company's obituary. I was like, no, you're not going to die. Like, you know, let's assume you're winning the best award in your industry. You're winning a HIMSS, right. You're winning a bio award, right?
Class award, Frost, whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So more putting a more positive spin on that. So it isn't a completely unique idea to us, but we put our own spin to make it more positive. And yeah, we've gotten teams of like 20 people in a room and break them into fours on that and have each one work on it. I love teams. And this is something every company can do out there. Take your CEO, put a product engineer, put a salesperson, like varied teams in the company and have them each write that speech. You know what's going to happen? You're probably going to take a piece from each one of them, and that's going to be your perfect messaging. So if you can't afford an agency, you're at a startup, do that exercise, get in a room for 2 hours, divide into groups of varied people of responsibility in your company, and go write an award speech and then give it to each other. Give the speech to each other and go, oh yeah, oh my gosh, that's a great line. No, yeah, right. That's a good position there. It works. It really, really works. And it's positive, right? Because people feel like, oh, we can do this. We can really do this. And maybe we will accept this award if we have this positioning.
So one of the other, major strategies is your goal post strategy. So you already alluded to it. I see it every day. You see it every day. This random acts of marketing, just, you know, whether it's a knee jerk reaction, we saw a lot of random acts of marketing, I think, with COVID, you know, people were just like, oh, you know, oh my, you know, right. But it happens quite a bit. You know, this looks interesting. My competitor's doing that. Oh, let's give that a whirl. Let's give that a whirl. And you're like, no random acts of marketing.
And that's
part of your goal.
What you're doing, right? Why are you doing this marketing campaign? What's the purpose behind it? What I see is often there's disconnect between executive leadership team and marketing team. That's because a lot of companies still don't have a chief marketing officer sitting at the table, which is something I also talk about in the book. I'm a big advocate for having a chief marketing officer if you have a chief growth officer. But that connection needs to be there between the executive leaders and marketing, whether or not you have a CMO. Because if the executive leaders aren't sharing that, like, hey, we want to exit in 3 years, or we want to form this partnership, or we're going in a different direction and completely reorging the company, then marketing is really, really slow to react to that. They can't anticipate this change, and the campaigns are not tied in this goal post strategy, where the post is performance objectives, strategies, and tactics. And you don't do the marketing strategies and tactics until you understand what the business objectives are.
Right, right. It reduces and eliminates randomness.
And that's where a lot of companies lose money. They just say, oh, we're doing this digital campaign and throwing money at it, but it's not working. Like, I was talking to three people today, they're like, LinkedIn doesn't work for this. And I'm like, who says? We have data that says it does work for this. Let me show it to you. It was just done so randomly, without content, without purpose, without a theme, without a tie-in to the business's unique value props.
It's like, oh, I think I'll do TikTok.
Okay. Right. I call it the sexy, shiny new thing, right? New thing is going to do it for us. I'm going to be on Pinterest. I'm going to be on TikTok. All those can work. Absolutely. Yeah. And even like people go, oh, can TikTok work in B2B? Of course it can. But it has to be done methodically, creatively, and tied to business goals, right? And you can't just do it for 2 months and say, oh, this didn't work.
Well, that's the thing too, right? Is that any marketing strategy has to have, you know, longevity to it, because you just nothing. I mean, lightning does strike in a bottle, but it's like lightning striking in a bottle. It's a really rare thing.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter in here. It's a short chapter, but an important one, about patience is a marketing virtue.
Yes, patience is a marketing virtue. Yes.
It really is, and leadership has to understand that. Like, again, if you just started to do marketing 2 months ago, you know, you're not getting contact forms filled out, most likely, unless you have a monopoly.
And then they jump to chapter 16 in lead gen, and you go say, no, go back to the patience chapter.
Go back to the patience chapter. Well, I mean, I'm realistic too, right? I'm a head of sales, so you know, I'm dependent on internal marketing as well, and it's a really, really important function. But at the same time, sales has got to produce, right? So I understand it from the other perspective too, but that planning has to be there. I see a lot of companies go and hire a whole bunch of salespeople, and then they don't hire marketing or don't give marketing the resources and budget they need to make those salespeople effective. And today we're in an industry, you know, we're in an area where 80% of the deals, 70% of the deal, we can argue around what the number is exactly, but a large percentage of that deal is closed before it even gets into the salesperson's hand.
Right.
They're way down the customer journey before they talk to a salesperson.
It didn't make my list. I mean, I just had a hard time picking which chapters I'm going to talk about today. But I will point out there is in one of the chapters, you talk about this idea that a well-performing marketing team, you know, if you're looking at a 35% closing ratio for sales, a well-performing marketing team can actually increase that to 50 or even higher.
Yeah, what that is, Carol, is actually like the percentage of leads coming from marketing, right? As opposed to just like a cold call or conference strategy or something like that, where the salespeople are going out and hunting.
Right.
You know, like inbound and marketing campaigns can be 65%.
Exactly.
You know, like that. So, and companies go, whoa, you know, and I'm like, yeah, well, here's a company that did it, right? That we've had companies who don't have any salespeople and grew 6x.
And that's why I know marketing.
And that's why I know marketing works. I'm like, oh my goodness, if you add sales, good salespeople on top of that, then you're golden. You're doing amazing things.
Another chapter that I really loved was, I think, because it really does speak to the analytics side of you, which was this chapter, it's chapter 10, where you actually give concrete formulas for figuring out what your marketing budget should be. It's not like, oh, a little bit of magic, a little bit of, I think this or I that or whatever. It's literally, here it is,
laid out. It's oftentimes what I see, take last year's budget and add or subtract. That's
right, exactly.
No. So I give a few different methodologies in the chapter on marketing budgets, because it's not a one size fits all, but there's a few that companies can go through and say, like, hey, should we look at percent of growth? Should we look at percent of revenue? Should we look percent of EBITDA? You know, like there's a few different ways to do that based on what your objectives are, going back to objectives, how much you want to grow. And then there's data in the book with tables that are not just our own. I did include our own agency data of what we see folks spend as a percent of revenue or percent of margin. But then there's other metrics in there from Forbes and other chief marketing officer interviews that ask how much they spend and by industry, which I think is really important. Because people go, oh, well, that's, you know, consumer, they have to spend. Or if I show them pharma data, they're like, oh, well, that's the B2C side of pharma and all the expensive TV ads. They're like, no, here's the B2B side of biotech. Here's the B2B side of healthcare on that and actual numbers. And people are often shocked when they see how much those numbers are. But then the light bulbs go on as we walk through scenarios of, like, if you're trying to launch a health tech company or a biotech company with a $50,000 marketing budget, I say,
sorry,
you got a lot of trouble, or you're going to be doing a lot of guerrilla marketing. And do you have time to do that along with all the R&D that you have to do? Right. And they often don't. If you don't have $250,000 to $300,000 to spend, as a startup today in the healthcare ecosystem, you're probably hand strapping your business. You know, you're setting yourself up for failure. Someone asked me that the other day. I was like, I'm going to tell you like really what the hard knock truth is on this. And you can do it in phases. But if you go to any venture capitalist or even an angels investors and say, my marketing budget is going to be 50K, they're going to laugh you out of the room.
They're not going to have a conversation with you. There's lots of reasons to buy the book, but that chapter is just so critical to, you know, the thinking, you know, once you've done on this strategy, like, you know, there are costs and like, okay, what should you be spending and having, creating a realistic picture. So what that looks like, I think, is just invaluable.
And there's a lot of marketers who know that number. They inherently know that number, have experienced that number, but they can't convince their bosses. So that's right. Why I wrote the chapter, so they could bring that to their bosses. They could bring it to the board, to the executive leadership, and go, here's the hard data.
So, okay, as we wind down here, we're getting close to our time together. Chapter 16, you know, top of the tower, lead gen. Okay, I didn't skip all the chapters. I'm now like, okay, or maybe I skipped them. I looked at 16 and then I went back and I read everywhere. And now I get to 16. Again, you know, the methodology is there to actually determine, not from a quality, I mean, some of it's qualitative, but a quantifiable side of things for lead gen.
Absolutely. Big on attribution. Agency here is really, really big at attribution, data analytics, and metrics. Track every possible thing that you can. Like, there's a UTM code on everything we do, right? So, and then there's AI sitting on top of database for us now, which is really, really fun on there, and looking at metrics across the board and what companies in life science and what companies in health tech spend. If you have that data and power and analytics behind your lead gen and you've done all the foundation work, it's actually one of the easier things to do. Sales cycles are still long in the healthcare industry, since we're on healthcare radio now and everyone knows that, right? There are a few things we can do to speed that. They're always going to be long because there's huge buying committees and, you know, a lot of red on the balance sheets and stuff right now. But actually getting people to raise their hands is one of the easier things. One of the harder things is nurture. Right. And nurturing through that lead generation, through the customer journey cycle. And so that's where a lot of creativity, analytics, and perseverance has to come in that nurturing and working with sales and marketing to get it across the finish line, getting the raise their hand. If you do creative really well, if you do your lead gen campaigns really well, it's going to be there. It's how do you nurture them so that when they're ready to buy, they're there for you.
We're going to close our conversation today, but we're going to have another one, because, you know, and I'm going to hearken to your last chapter where you wisely quote Star Trek and James Tiberius Kirk, because, you know, I'm there with you. I am there with you, you know, to boldly go, right? Yeah. I'm just going to read what you wrote here, which is the bold and brave world of marketing. Marketing, like exploration, is for the brave. It's finger paint mixed with logic, a true meld of left and right brain skills. Great marketing teams are a combination of orators, mathematicians, and artists, just like the Enterprise. That would be the Star Trek Enterprise. Had leaders, translators, scientists, and counselors. On the one hand, marketing requires a deep understanding of data and analytics to measure the success of marketing efforts, allocate resources effectively, and make informed decisions. On the other hand, it requires a level of creativity and intuition to generate fresh ideas, craft compelling messages, and engage with customers in meaningful way. That's a heck of a way to end. It's not quite the close of the book, but it's as the book winds down. Again, anyone who references Star Trek and James T. Kirk, I'm all for that. But
that was a gift to my husband and my daughter, who are big, huge Trekkies. I watched myself, but that was a gift to them. But it was a great metaphor in my mind too, for like being bold and brave, because marketers don't give themselves enough credit, and I find leadership doesn't often give them enough credit, and it's a very tough job, right? It's not just putting up the fancy banners and making a brochure, right? It's tough work. It is this left brain, right brain, some intuition, some creativity, some analytics. And we have to do all that. Every brain cell needs to be going on. So marketers out there, you need to give yourself a pat on the back. You're doing really, really hard, bold work. And at the same time, hopefully everyone realizes that when we create this team of analysts, translators, creatives, that we can do amazing entrepreneurial things.
Chris, so great talking with you. Everybody, please check out Stop Starvation Marketing. Chris, we'll have to get together again. There's just too much to talk about. Too much fun.
Carol, it's a pleasure. It's always fun speaking with you.
You can learn more about Chris Slocum at Clarity Quest. That's clarityqst.com. And be sure to connect with her on LinkedIn. Learn more about the book Stop Starvation Marketing on Amazon or on the Marketing Learning Hub on the Clarity Quest website. You can connect with me on LinkedIn and learn more about the show on the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. Until next time, I want to know, what's your tagline?